Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction's Patreon, episode 16. I call BS.
Woohoo!
That woohoo you just heard is none other than our guest host, Miss Paige Wesley from Cult Podcast. All of you people listening here have already heard the main episode, so you undoubtedly know who Paige is. Paige, how are you doing this afternoon?
Pretty good. A little concerned that you said afternoon when it is almost 8 p.m., but sure.
Oh, really broken that fourth wall there, Paige. You know, see, here's the key. Now, Paige, I know you do a lot of podcasts yourself. I want to give you a tip here. You always have to talk to the audience from when they're listening to you. And it turns out that all people listen to podcasts in the afternoon.
Really?
Yes. Little known fact.
It changed for us during pandemic, but ours, we would get our biggest listens from 3 a.m. to 9 a.m. because people would commute.
Yes. I'll tell you what is I have obviously been working from home doing regular, like doing boring paper pushing archaeology, but recently decided, oh, hey, regular 9 to 5 isn't enough. I'm going to go do some field work in my old stomping grounds out in the desert. And the only way to get enough of that done to make it worthwhile is to work 10 hour days in the desert on Saturdays and Sundays. And so I started commuting this weekend to go do that. And I forgot how desperately you miss content because I go through, like, my commute is 3.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm driving around from place to place, from site to site, I am in the truck and I would listen to podcasts too. I go through all of, like, during pandemic, I've been like, oh, my favorite podcast is up. Fuck that. I'm on to like C-level podcasts now.
Yes.
Because I go through like 5 hours a day when I'm driving.
Yeah. I mean, I have to listen to episodes that my shows are putting out to make sure that there's nothing like cancelable in them.
Yeah.
And after I get through those, because I don't have a commute anymore, I'm lucky to get to other shows. But when I was commuting, I had days laid out where I'm like, on this day, I listen to these two shows. On this day, I listen to these. And now I feel like I'm just not catching up with anything. And I only hear my own voice and it's driving me insane.
Yes. And how frustrating is it when your favorite podcast for that Tuesday drive doesn't come out at the right time? And you're like, you've ruined my day.
Yeah. I feel so much anxiety when our show doesn't come out because, hey, stuff happens. Weird shit happens. It's a pandemic. We had like a week where a bunch of people had like personal stuff going on. I had like a death in the family. Also, it was Christmas. Like episodes didn't come out. It was just the way it worked. And I know how crazy I feel when I would be stuck in a car and be like, what do I listen to now? I have to find a new show. So yeah, I feel the pull, the pangs of guilt whenever we can't get something out on time.
Yeah, I forgot just how bad commutes are without podcasts. So hopefully all of you guys out there, if you do have a commute, I feel you on that now. I forgot. We've all forgotten how bad it was.
Might I recommend Black Box Down? That's a new one I've added to my rotation.
Oh, what's that?
It's a podcast about plane crashes.
Ooh.
And how they've improved the airline industry because of them.
Have they done the one yet where the Korean pilot crashed because like he was making mistakes and the co-pilots knew he was making mistakes, but because of Korean culture, they were too afraid to mention it to him. So they just sat there while the fuel tanks ran out and they all died.
No, yeah. I haven't heard that one. I did hear one where a pilot let his teenage kids drive the plane for a while. And then this past week, I listened to one where a malfunctioning...
Wait, and they crashed it?
Oh, yeah. Like... It's horrible. The one this week, there was a fighter jet and a Hughes commercial flight. So like Howard Hughes's company back in the 70s. The malfunctioning fighter jet was flying too low to be caught by radar at the time. So as the plane took off, like the commercial flight took off, it sheared the cockpit off the plane.
Whoa!
But one of the guys ejected from the fighter jet and survived. And he's the lone survivor of both crafts.
It's
nuts. But yeah, super fascinating show if you want something a little different for your commute.
I used to fly ultralights, which is basically like it's like an airplane that you could fit in the back of a Honda, and then you just drive around and you see an open field and you're like, I could take off from there. And but it sounds
very dangerous.
Oh yeah, it's basically like a paraglider, like you would go paragliding with like a lawnmower engine strapped to your back. You're like fan man. I used to do that, and I didn't have anything. I didn't have a radio. I wasn't in contact with anybody, and I was flying in airspace that was supposed to be clear Class G airspace, like totally fine. But every once in a while, somebody just doesn't do it. And one time, I'm there, and I'm at like 2,000 feet. And keep in mind, in this aircraft, it's so small, your body is part of the aircraft, like your body is the structure of the aircraft itself. And I'm flying, and a fucking G6 came within like 50 feet of me, and I have a maximum flight speed of like 18 miles an hour. This thing came by and just went straight through. And I just remember thinking, like, I was almost the black box recording on that. Like, I was almost like, oh God, what's that? And then
yeah, just dead. Well, that was the one this week. Their closing speed was over 600 miles an hour. They had 3 seconds to react. And I'm like, no one could do that.
No,
like, no one could react. That's impossible. You know, this was unavoidable.
I saw him coming out of the clouds, and he just went right by me so close. And I just remember, like, everybody always says, like, oh man, I would shit myself or something like that. And I just remember thinking, like, I didn't have time to shit myself. Like, I would have loved to have the luxury of being able to shit myself.
That would have given me time to, like, move the plane.
Yeah.
Would have tried to do that first and then concentrated on clenching next.
Let's move right on. I call BS.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right, I call BS is a game where I read 4 science news articles, some of which are real and some of which are BS, standing for bad science. They can all be true, all be false, or any combination thereof in between. They are independent variables, each and every one of them. Now, Damien famously has played this game for 7 years and lost every time. Again, never missed 1 week in 7 years, lost every single time. And the audience, let me tell you, Paige, the audience has gotten livid at this point. They are so mad at him for not trying even slightly that they complain quite a bit. But we're hoping that Paige can come out here and show him how it's done.
By lost, do you mean he's gotten none right or just didn't get enough right to beat you?
Well, before pandemic, this was a contest between Damien and the guest scientist, because every week we had a guest scientist on. So it was who could get more correct. And of course, the tie always went to the scientist, much like the tie goes to the runner in baseball. That's just common sense. But Damien was never able to win. And now that we are in pandemic mode, we do it where Damien plays to see if he can't get them all right. And he has, again, never been able to win. So he just keeps disappointing over and over again. Oh, Paige, so do you think you understand the rules and you're ready to play?
I do.
All right. Article number 1. A new study outlines a newly discovered superpower of sea slugs, the ability to rip off their own heads and then crawl around until the heads regrow a completely new body. Paige, is this science or bad science?
I want this to be science so bad because I think it's cool. Now, what I do think, because slugs are, I realize that I am probably wrong, closely related to cephalopods.
I'd have to check. I actually am not 100% sure on that. They're a mollusk.
Mollusk. Yeah. Okay. They're gastropods. Yeah. I believe. I would think that potentially this is true. I hope this is science. Fingers crossed.
Okay. So are you saying science?
I'm going to say science.
All right, Paige. This is science.
Yes.
Very good. And super interesting. So other animals like flatworms, they can be cut up and regenerate from those cuttings.
Segmented, yes.
Yeah, but a sea slug is a much more complicated animal. It has a heart, it has organs, it has those kind of things, unlike a flatworm, which is basically just uniform across its entire body. So this is really, really interesting. What's even more impressive is this isn't something that happens like a newt or a salamander or something, where a salamander will get its leg bitten off and then it will grow its leg back. In this case, what they observed is it actually detaches its own head. It takes like an hour and it like pulls its own head off of its body, and then its head starts crawling around the place.
So it plays by Evil Dead rules. Got it.
And then eventually the head regrows a whole new body.
It's like Tony Shalhoub's character in Men in Black.
Actually is, except it's the reverse. I think they shot his head off and his head grew back. In this case, the head falls off.
He would have
off.
Had to shoot his own head off.
And the body, by the way, stays alive for like a month. Now, it doesn't grow back a head, but it just stays alive just wandering around the place for like chicken had the head cut off, but for an extended period of time.
The reason I kind of thought this was science is because, correct me if I'm wrong, octopuses or squids can sometimes detach parts of their legs, etc.
Yeah.
To like distract a predator and then grow it back.
Yeah, and this
but
is
then
extreme.
Also I was thinking about flatworms too, and like tapeworms, where you can segment them into. Yeah.
By the way, nice use of octopuses instead of octopi, which is incorrect. Most people mess that up.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Octopi is a
my ignorance paid off in this case.
Octopi is a misconjugation because it's Greek instead, so it would be octopuses and or octopodi, but not octopi, which is a wrong phrasing that people commonly use.
Bad grammar.
Yeah, and so what's interesting is like different animals can kind of live different times when you decapitate them. In this case, the sea slug is a kind of champion at this. It's able to actually regrow an entire body, but a lot of animals can live a pretty long time. So a good example that we are more familiar with on a day-to-day basis that still surprises people is to think of something like a rattlesnake.
Or chickens.
Yeah, chickens, right? But like people will frequently decapitate a rattlesnake and then get bitten by that rattlesnake.
Yeah.
Because it's still alive. It still bites. And you're like, what the fuck? Is it just a reflex? And it's like, no, that thing's actually still alive. He's trying to bite you. And here's why. We're used to being mammals and dealing with mammals, and even to some extent chickens, who are semi-warm-blooded as well. We are warm-blooded creatures, which means we metabolize oxygen really fast. And so the second our head is severed, we're not getting oxygenated blood to our brain anymore, and we just basically die. It's pretty quick, maybe a few seconds there or something like that. A cold-blooded reptile like a snake, it doesn't need that much oxygen to its brain. So you cut off the rest of its body, it's like, fuck it, bitch, I'm still around for a while. Like, I got this. I will bite your ass.
Try decapitating me.
Yeah.
Biting through your foot. Yeah.
Yeah, so like similar to that. So different animals have like different tolerances of this. And apparently the sea slug is the fucking Olympian of this and is just able to actually regrow its body, part of which is probably because it feeds on chloroplasts. And we think in doing that, it actually obtains the ability from these chloroplasts to make energy from the sun for long periods of time.
So it's like part plant.
Yes. So they turn their body green. There's a few animals that do this where they essentially absorb in photosynthetic plants or fungi or bacteria or something, and then are able to utilize their photosynthetic abilities in themselves, which is pretty fucking cool superpower.
Like a sponge?
I don't know if a sponge does that with photosynthesis.
I just thought about that, like SpongeBob SquarePants does, but that's not science.
But a sponge does something else that's similar to this, which is I always thought of as like the lamest thing ever, which is like if you're going after a sponge, it's like, leave me alone. And it'll just like throw its organs out at you, like, eat these, yes. Leave me alone. Well, this isn't what the sea slug does because it takes the sea slug too long. So this isn't to get away from predators. They actually think that it's doing this to get away from parasites. So like its body gets infested with parasites. And it's like, fuck this. I don't need this body anymore. I'm out of here.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah.
Gross. But interesting.
Doesn't it also seem like the greatest example of running away from your problems? Like, buddy, come on, just solve your fucking parasites. Don't ditch your body. Like, come on.
It's not you, body. It's me.
You're the deadbeat dad of your own body.
Yeah. I'm going out for cigarettes, body. You stay here.
All right. On to article number two. For the first time ever, this year's winner of the World Memory Championships is just a regular person and not a person with a photographic memory. Is this science or bad science?
I'm going to call this, okay, so we just finished a huge series on Satanic Panic, which deals a lot with the science of memory, and I'm going to call this bad science because there is some debate as to whether photographic memory truly exists.
Boom, Paige, you got it, and you got the hint. The hint is photographic memory doesn't exist. Yeah, we have looked at this a bunch. This is kind of like an urban legend. So if you define photographic memory the way we typically do, which is the ability to recall pages of text, numbers, or something similar in great detail without the visualization that comes with something like eidetic memory, then we have never seen that. We have never seen it exist. There's a lot of people who have claimed it. Every time they've tested it, it has failed. There is something called eidetic memory, where you can keep a vision in your head. So you see something like a picture. A lot of great artists have kind of shown this, which is you see a picture and then you are able to keep that picture in a visual memory for a longer time than your average person. Even then, you're talking about moments, like a few minutes or something like that. You're not talking indefinitely. And the other thing is, eidetic memory has only been confirmed to really exist in young children under 12. We think language processing actually impairs the ability of eidetic memory to continue in later in life. There's a few adults who have shown some eidetic memory components, but we're talking like for spans of 30 seconds. So really, really essentially kind of a myth, which is a myth I grew up believing. Like I just grew up thinking that Sherlock Holmes was like fucking could look back to any book he'd ever read and look at like a smear on the page and think of somebody's fucking fingerprint or something. And it was total bullshit that was just fed to us in the 80s by sitcoms.
Yep. I mean, I would say that some people have better memory than others.
Totally.
And I think also people can train their memory to be better, and you can actively make mental notes of things if you're specifically looking for things.
So that is a perfect segue, Paige, into what this science article actually is about, which is they did a test of what is considered to be the greatest memory technique. It's an ancient Greek technique. Paige, are you aware of any memory techniques that are particularly useful?
I mean, I've heard of some mnemonic devices. Mm-hmm. I find them to not work super well for me personally, just the way I remember things, where a lot of times it's like linking them to a word or things like that.
Sure.
Like when I was testing for Mensa, that was a huge thing that they tried to like hammer home, that you should try to use mnemonic devices to figure things out. For me, I very much remember things by kind of putting myself back into the scenario where it happened and almost trying to like relive it. But no, I don't know of any like really specific fancy ones that supposedly work great.
So there is one that essentially every world's memory champion and memory Olympics, which are two different things, but are basically the same thing.
Oh God, it's like Miss America or
Miss Universe. Yeah.
Miss Universe. Yeah.
It is essentially the same thing. Essentially, all of them use the exact same technique. They're all normal people. They probably have pretty good working memories, but nothing spectacular. And almost anybody here can do this, where you can memorize strings of words, letters, numbers that are sometimes thousands of things long. Almost every one of these people can memorize an entire deck of cards very, very quickly. And it's a simple technique that you at home can use, especially useful if you're ever doing public speaking, stand-up comedy, anything like that where you're putting together a long set. And it's called the method of loci. This is an ancient Greek technique. Socrates talks about doing this.
Socrates, nice.
Socrates, yeah. And it's fairly simple. The idea is to pick a place that you are familiar with. And you'd want a large place, so not like, you know, a house or something like this, but think of a college campus, maybe a workplace, a neighborhood that you walk through. Some place that you can picture walking through very easily in your head. You've done it 1,000 times. And the way it works is you place yourself at the beginning of a tract of walking through this neighborhood, campus, whatever it is. And as you walk, you stop by the first landmark. So let's say I'm walking through like my old college campus and I start in this one place and I know that there is this bench right here. Okay, I stop at this bench. And if we're doing a deck of cards, all right, the first thing I'm going to remember is the Seven of Diamonds. I'm putting the Seven of Diamonds in my mind on this bench. Okay, now I'm walking to the next place. And the next thing I remember is the physics building. And next to the physics building, I'm putting the Jack of Hearts. You do this technique where you walk through a place that you know and you associate whether it's a word, a thought, a memory, a specific card from a deck of cards. You associate that thing with a place in there. Then all you have to do is re-walk through that place in your head and you are able to remember what those things are. Now you might be thinking to yourself, aren't I just going to forget the order? Like, aren't I going to mix up where the Seven of Diamonds were? Like, did I put that at the physics building or at the bench? And the reality is, if you actually visualize this in your head when you are doing the memorization, so you don't just do it, like you don't just tell yourself it, you visualize yourself putting that seven of diamonds on that bench. It becomes a very effective tool. And the more you use it, that same memory place that you choose becomes more and more effective. And that's how every one of these memory Olympics people do it, where they have one place they know really well. They know every square inch. They walk it every day. And then they just put these different things in there, and they are able to remember a series of 1,000 different random words just by doing this. And everybody who's listening to this, maybe not 1,000, but to some extent, can do a superhuman memory feat by doing the exact same thing, especially if you practice it frequently.
That's actually how, so we were talking before we started recording about how I worked in retail for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. And for the last 10 years of that, I worked in a store that had over 10,000 SKUs in it. Uh-huh. And I knew where every single thing was because literally I walked it every day. Yeah. I would have to restock all those items.
Sure.
And so anytime anyone was like, where is this one item out of 10,000 items, you just kind of like Rolodex your way through it.
Yeah.
And you know exactly where it is.
That's almost, that's a great example of a real life version of the method of loci, actually.
It's the actual, Mm-hmm.
So in this case, they took a bunch of random people who were not specifically good memory people, and they gave them these long lists of words. And then they broke up the groups into three different groups. One was getting memory method of loci treatment. One was getting another memory treatment, another memory trick, mnemonic device, and one got none at all, and they were the placebo. Out of the first group, the ones that used method of loci, they were shortly thereafter, I think it was like 20 minutes after, they were able to get 62 words from the list. Those who trained in the other mnemonic devices were able to get 41 from the list, and those who didn't train at all were able to get 36. So the mnemonic only helped a little bit. The method of loci almost doubled the memory of the average person. Again, these are randomly assigned groups of random people. None of these are professional memory people. After 24 hours, the people who were trained with method of loci were able to still get 56 words versus 30 of the other mnemonic device and 21 in the control group. They then tested them 4 months later, and the method of loci people got 50 words! 50!
That they could still retain from that initial test. That's crazy.
The mnemonic people got 30 and the regular people got 21. So you are seeing, I mean, again, you're not talking about, after 4 months, you're not talking about a doubling. It's 2.5 times memory. And these are randomly assigned groups. So these aren't some specific memory people. That makes you, if you can do something 2.5 times better than the average person, you're a fucking superhero.
Well, okay, real life proof again. So they closed the store that I used to work at, but there's the same company has another store across town.
Uh-huh.
I know where everything is in that store. I didn't work in that store. I just know where it's laid out, where it was on the maps, and can find my way around it. I have not. I could walk into that store once a year and still find everything. It just sticks with you when you've had that much kind of both muscle memory and then really just kind of beating it into your brain where things are.
And it turns out that it's because you remember spatial things much differently than you remember a random list of words, and you encode those much differently. And it's because your brain has to, remember that one spot in the sidewalk has a 1/2 inch bump in the concrete, because otherwise you're going to trip every time you get to it. So you have to have very specific memories of locational things in your brain in order to get around the world that you don't have to have for lists of random numbers and letters. So you're using the best part of your brain's memory, the superhuman part of it, to remember the non-superhuman stuff. What was even more interesting is they then put people in fMRIs while they were doing this and looked at their brains. And what really surprised the researchers is they weren't necessarily that surprised that it was so effective. We've known for a while that it's essentially the most effective memory technique. What was really surprising was when we looked at it, it turns out that the brains of those people who were using that method of loci were actually working much less than everybody else's brain, especially in the areas of memory and cognition and processing. So what that means is your brain is essentially being so efficient because it's using its most effective means of geolocation memory to do this, that not only are you able to remember more, you're able to remember more while using your brain less.
Fascinating. I mean, that doesn't surprise me, though. I mean, if I have to think about my house, I know where everything is in my house.
Yeah.
Like if I'm just picturing walking through my house, that doesn't take a lot of exertion. I'm not like straining to remember where things are. So if you were to essentially just add a layer to that memory that is kind of not a strenuous memory, I know that's a weird way of phrasing it, but if I tried to remember a list of words, just a list of words, I'm going to have to kind of think back, what were right. they, as opposed to like, okay, I'm walking through my living room, here's where everything is.
But it shows us yeah. how silly we are that we work so much harder to get such a worse result. You know, like,
oh, I wish I'd known this in school.
Yeah. I know.
It would have changed my world.
All right, article number 3. New research into butterflies have found that their numbers are dramatically decreasing due to the use of pesticides in agriculture. Paige, is this science or bad science?
This one I'm torn, because I do know that there have been decreases in butterflies, but I would think that it's climate-based, not pesticide-based. So I'm going to call this bad science.
Paige, not only is this bad science, but you yes. fucking hit the nail on the head!
Yes!
Oh my goodness, this is fantastic. So you are killing this, Paige. So they are dramatically declining due to yes. climate change. Butterfly populations have been declining about 1.6% per year since that's 1977. Yeah, I mean, since 1977, if you go down one percentage point, that's quite a bit. And this has been known for a while, and it's usually attributed to agricultural pesticide use, which is known to specifically harm butterflies and caterpillars. However, this new study found that the decline is present even in butterflies that live localized. Like, obviously, monarch butterflies travel a big distance, so you couldn't really do right. this with them. But there are a lot of butterflies that live in very localized areas, and there are ones that live in localized, pristine mountain climates and national parks and stuff far from agricultural pesticide use. And they were seeing the decline too. And even more damning, the biggest impacts are in the places hardest hit by climate change, specifically in areas where fall temperatures had risen significantly more than summer temperatures over the past several decades, i.e., the southwest of the United States.
Yeah, I was going to say, oh, you mean where we live?
Yeah.
Yes. So, I have noticed.
So, yes, they were able to say, look, the correlation does not fit with this being due to agriculture use. Undoubtedly, there's some pesticide use harming butterflies and stuff, but this population really seems to be affected mainly by climate variations, because insects are very temperature sensitive as to when they mate, when they eat, when they do things. And once you throw all that thing off, then you're going to mess with their cycles. This is really neat. I always love these studies. There's another one that came out this week that we didn't cover, but there's an ongoing debate in archaeology about what caused the megafaunal extinction in the Pleistocene. And is it human beings showing up to North America and killing all the big animals, or is it climate change and the earth gets warmer and it kills everything? And it's been kind of raging back and forth. And this week, a really interesting paper came out where they basically correlated the size of animals, the average size of animals to when they're around humans, and then the average size of animals to when the climate changes. And it was like the average size of an animal in North America when human beings got here, 20 some odd thousand years ago, was 216 pounds. That was the average size. So you got to imagine Damn. Birds. Yeah, big ass animals running around here. Lots of megafauna. And when you correlate that to climate change, you see that in absence of humans, that on average, the size changes by like 5 pounds. So it drops down to about 211 pounds because of climate change. And then if you add humans into the equation and you look at it, the correlation goes that the average size drops down to 17 pounds. Humans Jeez. Come to an environment. And so you're like,
we're like the Borg, man.
We really
it's
are.
Bad.
Except it's, even the Borg let you live. They just take you over and you're one of them.
Yeah,
They're really
they
more of a gang.
Hardware.
We're the gang that kills you. We don't even give you a chance to join.
Yeah. We're Thanos.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and so very, very interesting stuff, because essentially what that means, you know, in the terms of the human thing, is that we can link those extinctions mainly to human-caused events. And in the case of this and the butterflies, we can link that much more to climate change than we ever could to pesticide use. Very, very interesting stuff. Kind of sad, if you ask me, because it's much easier to stop. Like, we stopped using DDT when it killed a bunch of eagles, but,
right.
like, we're not going to stop climate change.
Right, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Maybe we'll get cool new animals like lava butterflies. Who knows?
All right. And lastly, article number 4. Researchers have revealed that we may be close to a UIV, or universal influenza vaccine, that could guard against all flus as opposed to seasonal vaccines targeting whichever variant is spreading that year. Paige, is this science or bad science?
As much as I would hope for this to be real, I feel like everything I know about the flu and coronaviruses in general is that they are variable by nature. And so that would make this impossible. So that sounds like it's bad science.
Are you sure it's Paige? Are you sure it's bad science and not science?
No, damn. Well, okay. I'm wondering if, given the advances with the way they've done the coronavirus vaccine, which is different than other vaccines, it's not a live vaccine, maybe that could make a universal flu vaccine possible. So science?
Paige is correct! It becomes the first comedian ever to win I Call BS. Damien, eat that! Yes. I don't know how you've lost so often. Finally, all those fans who's complained to me with literally millions of emails over the years can start saying, like, look, we comedians, we can have some self-respect because at least Paige Wesley can come out here and win I Call BS. Yes, Paige, and you actually hit on some true things there. So, amazing news. It's helped along by the tragedy that is COVID. So, let's start with the problems with the current flu. One, it has huge death numbers. So what's really funny is, you know, all these people who are like, hey, everybody's bitching about COVID. I didn't hear you talking about the flu. I've been yelling on this show about flu.
It kills everybody.
Yeah, it's like 50K a year in the United States. And yeah. I've been yelling about flu and flu shots for the past 7 fucking years. So the flu is a big deal. It kills a lot of people here, kills a lot of people worldwide. The problem is it has variability. So every year we get a different flu. It always comes from Southeast Asia. It comes from the same place every year. And basically what happens is, during flu season, which is the winter, and it's the winter not necessarily because it's cold, but because it's dry, and then the cold keeps people inside, as we saw with COVID. Dry air allows the flu to spread better. Cold puts people inside next to each other, then it spreads. So every year, a new flu pops out of Southeast Asia, and then it spreads around the world. What we try and do is figure out, what flu is it going to be this year? And there's always 2 or 3 popping around Southeast Asia. So we got to sample around a bunch, and we go, we think this is the dominant one. And then we try and make a vaccine for that. We work on crazy levels to pump that out. And that takes, you know, 8 months or something to get that going and to get that effectiveness. And then we can produce it enough to be around for the next year for when it comes to the rest of us here in the Western Hemisphere. So that vaccine creation process takes a while. The variability of the flu takes a while. A good flu vaccine is like 60% effective, meaning if everyone got the flu vaccine, there'd still be about 40% of the people who would still get the flu if they were exposed to it, as opposed to something like the COVID vaccines, which are now 95% effective and 100% effective at stopping death and serious hospitalizations. So we have a way to fight it, a flu vaccine. It is not nearly as effective as other vaccines. We're always behind the eight ball. And a lot of times, by the way, we miss. We pick the wrong variant of the flu that's floating around Southeast Asia, and now the vaccine we make is 10 or 20% effective. And so that is why we are in the current situation we are in. Flu also mutates pretty quickly and changes as it moves around and can go in and out of animals like birds and pigs.
Or bats.
But researchers have been working for a while to create something called a universal influenza vaccine that can combat all strains of the virus with a high level of effectiveness, essentially wiping out the seasonal flu. So a new paper described 2 potential targets for a UIV: the hemagglutinin, or HA protein, and neuraminidase, or NA proteins. And basically, these 2 proteins are conserved across all or most different strains of the flu, meaning if we could find antibodies to attack these things, if we can train your immune system to attack these specific proteins, they should work against most types of flus, not just the seasonal flu that's coming around that year. Much of the promise, though, of a UIV is made possible by the leaps in effectiveness that we've seen out of the COVID pandemic. So today, the world's first mRNA vaccines, which Paige mentioned, the Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccines, will soon be some of the most distributed vaccines in the entire world. And they're a whole new type of vaccine that has never been used before. We've talked about mRNA vaccines a bunch on this show, but just to review quickly, you are basically putting in a messenger RNA, which your cells then send to ribosomes to make proteins. This is how the cells in your body work normally. This is how you make all the proteins in your body. Usually mRNA translates off your DNA, goes to ribosomes, makes proteins, and proteins are what do everything in your body. In this case, the mRNA codes for the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2. Your body then produces the spike protein and then attacks it. So it's a pretty neat way to do it. And it's also much quicker than the normal vaccine route. Normal vaccines, so seasonal flu is one that we have like gotten on board with. We know how to make it. We've done it. We do it every single year. We have huge multi-million dollar infrastructures. It takes us about 8 months. Other things that are new novel viruses, new novel things, usually take many years. Paige, do you know how long it took us to make the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine?
We made that in, I mean, definitely under a year. I want to say like 4 months or something crazy like that.
2 days. It took us 2 days. So the Chinese published the SARS-CoV-2 genetic, essentially they published its genetic blueprint. And within 2 days, both Moderna and Pfizer had basically just taken that and said, okay, boom, here's how we make an mRNA version of the spike protein that's on there and blah, blah, blah. Everything else after that was testing. But it took us 2 days to make that vaccine. And with that type of turnaround, which you could do with mRNA vaccines, and now producing 95% effectiveness. Now, keep in mind, that was the first one we did. 2 days in, we made a vaccine that was 95% effective. If we're doing something like a universal flu vaccine where we have the same common enemy for years on end, we could maybe bump that up to near 100% effectiveness, especially if we're targeting this NA or HA protein, which is conserved across most strains of the flu virus. This is really great news because not only the deaths it caused, but think of just like the misery, the people who stay home from work, that just all the pain and strain that it causes to our daily lives. If you could get rid of the flu, you would change so much of life. And here's something that's interesting. I learned on this show only maybe a few months back. The flu that goes around now is basically a variant of a flu that came around in 1968. It's a seasonal flu that came out of Hong Kong. Before that, we didn't have a yearly seasonal flu. It's like in my parents' lifetime, there was not a yearly seasonal flu.
That's mind-boggling.
Like there were flus that came through, but it wasn't until a specific flu in 1968 came through that was able to mutate enough that on an annual basis, it would keep coming back around and reinfecting people that we had an idea of it. It was before it was like, oh no, it's 1928. It's flu year. We better stay inside. But now after 1968, it was, oh, guess what? Every year is flu year. And so we think of it as like this thing that's from time immemorial. It's not even outside of my parents or probably your parents' lifetimes, right? And so what does that mean? It means it doesn't have to be with us forever. And this fatalistic idea of, well, it's always been in my life, it always will be, is bullshit. We can beat it. Fucking polio was always in people's lives for a while, and then we beat it. And we now have the tools to do that, in large part thanks to things like COVID, which jumped up our ability to produce vaccines drastically. And so, you know, it's one of those silver linings in these clouds that, you know, yes, we had this horrible global pandemic. We've killed 500,000 people in this country alone. I think close to 3 million worldwide, maybe more than that. And that is truly horrible. But maybe in the end, we will end up saving lives with a lot of the medications and stuff we discovered, similar to like World War II. World War II, one of the most destructive events in mankind's history. Nuclear bombs used, they're the only time in war, blah, 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 blah. But we got antibiotics widespread use out of it. We got plastics. We got a bunch of stuff that saved people's lives after that. And so maybe we can use COVID to be one of those things where we go, this was really horrible, but we're going to make the future much, much better.
I've been watching the mRNA vaccine process very closely because the medication I'm on affects my immune system, which means I can't take live vaccines anymore. And so for me to find out that not only was it effective, but that I could still take it because it technically works differently is great, because there's a lot of immunocompromised people that fully would get vaccinated if they could. And so the fact that potentially this is an avenue for them to do so is even better.
Yeah, and so. I'll want to make sure I clarify, obviously Pfizer and Moderna, those are both mRNAs, but Johnson & Johnson, that's an adenovirus vaccine, so that's different. The new Novavax, that's actually a whole new type of completely synthetic vaccine, that's completely different. So when we're talking about mRNAs, we're not talking about all the COVID vaccines, just the Moderna and the Pfizer ones, but really interesting, because I actually will be kind of interested to see what the studies come out when they start looking at immunocompromised people using these.
The company that makes the medication I take sent an email out that was like, you can get vaccinated, please do. Okay, bye.
Very, very cool. Congratulations, Paige, for being the first ever comedian to win Icon VS. This is amazing. I can't wait to tell Damien he's going to cry even harder than he usually does when he loses.
I'm going to take your job, Damien. I'm not.
Thank you, Paige Wesley, for coming out and being a wonderful co-host for Science Faction. This was fantastic.
Thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
And thank you, audience, for coming out to Science Faction's Patreon 16, where you learned all about the superpower of sea slugs to detach their heads, how you too can be a world memory champion, why butterflies around the world are dying, but it's not from pesticides, and how we're close to creating a UIV, or Universal Influenza Vaccine. Thank you so much for joining me, and come on back next week for Science Faction 552.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.